My name is Ivan Elon, and I'm the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute, and I'll be moderating the session as well as making some concluding comments. But our main two speakers are here today to talk about, is the war on terror creating more terrorism? Data show that international terrorism has gone up since the very broad and public war on terror began at the beginning of the decade. Is this a coincidence, or has the war on terror been counterproductive? And if so, why has it been counterproductive? Can the war on terror be adjusted to be more effective, or is the war itself a problem? And calling it a war, is that a problem? To start with, how real is the threat from future terrorism on U.S. soil of another 9/11 style attack? What's the threat there? How are we safer before now than we were before is the question that's always asked. And I guess that's still an applicable question. Does 9/11 a fluke event, or does the threat continue? If the threat has been overstated, is this to justify unneeded government programs and law enforcement efforts? What is the root cause or causes of anti-U.S. terrorism? No one ever seems to talk about this. And instead of fighting a war on terror, can those causes be ameliorated in some other ways? What alternatives do we have to a war on terror to reduce terrorism? Our panelists will address such issues and more. The panelists are Ian Lustig, the Best W. Hayman Chair in Political Science from the University of Pennsylvania, and author of our new policy paper, Our Own Strength Against Us, the War on Terror as a Self-Inflicted Disaster. And I think you've all got that on your chairs there. So this is an excellent policy paper that Ian wrote for the Institute here. And he'll be speaking first. And then commenting on the paper will be Gareth Porter, who's an independent investigative journalist and historian. And then I'll conclude with some comments myself. And then, of course, we'll have much time for Q&A, which should be the most interesting part of the morning. So I'll turn it over to Ian, and he'll get started. I wanted to mention also, he is obviously no novice in the terror area. He wrote this book, Trapped in the War on Terror. And so you can copy that title down. We were supposed to have some books to sell, but they didn't arrive. So you'll have to copy the title down and go out and run out and get a copy. So I'll turn it over to you, Ian.
Thanks. Thank you, Ivan. It's a pleasure to be here again. I was very grateful for the opportunity that you gave me shortly after the book came out, when you and Randy Beers and Ed Lutwak and I were able to discuss it. I've been around the country talking about this book, which you should get on Amazon. It's cheaper that way and a lot easier. Okay, so I'm going to try to pose some of those questions that Ivan mentioned that are addressed in the policy paper. I'm going to give quick, hopefully pithy, renditions of those questions and give some answers and then set the stage for hearing from the two other panelists and your questions and comments. So first let me start with the first question, which is a kind of basic one. What is real and what is not? I'm a professor, so we ask questions like this. What is real and what is not? Well, let me tell you a story that is in the policy paper. I was at a lecture at a well-known Northeastern university in the spring of 2004, and the speaker was the official in the executive office building who was responsible for encouraging scientists to become part of the war on terror, social scientists and natural scientists. And there was a large lecture hall filled with us, and we were being told in enthusiastic terms that there was lots of money in this, and we should not worry about whether we had thought our research had to do with terrorism, because it's almost certain that given that we need to think outside the box, and you all are very smart people and you need grants, you should be applying to us for grants to study the terrorism problem and help in the war on terror, because this is a problem which the scientists really have to take over. And when I heard that the scientists had to take it over, not the government, it wasn't a political problem, I raised my hand at the end of the talk, and I said, there was one problem that we all agree was a real problem, and that was when it looked like the Germans were going to get the bomb before we did in World War II. And the government set up the Manhattan Project and basically gave all the resources that any scientist could want to the scientists to solve this problem, get a nuclear weapon before Germany does. Okay, so let's treat that Manhattan Project, I said, as a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10, when the problem is real and science is therefore given complete control to solve it. And let's make a 1 Wag the Dog, the movie Wag the Dog, where there is no problem whatsoever, but politically it's necessary to, it's useful to pretend and treat it as if there's a problem. Okay, remember, I'm talking to the official who's in charge of giving out these grants and recruiting scientists for the war on terror. So I said, so where is the war on terror? Close to the Manhattan Project, a real problem, give science control, as you said, or close to Wag the Dog, the movie Wag the Dog. It's produced. It's so he said, I can't answer that question in public. Well, the fact is that I had the proverbial couple beers with him after the talk, and there were several other people there. I was not the only person. And I said, okay, we're not exactly in public anymore. Let me repeat my question, which I did, and 10 Manhattan Project, 1 Wag the Dog. And I said, so where is the war on terror? And he said, it's somewhere between 1 and 1.5. So what is real and what is not? Now, the next question I want to pose is, why should there be a war on terror? And the posing of that question is itself what I want to remark on. I don't know how many of you are Jewish. I'm Jewish. We have a Seder coming up. And in that Seder, in that ceremonial meal, it's traditional for the youngest child, to ask questions and for there to be a story about sons who ask different kinds of questions, good ones or bad ones. And then there's the baby in the cradle for the one who doesn't even know how to ask a question. You should say for him. Well, that's how I feel about this question. Why should there be a war on terror? I say that because there have been countless polls, whether it's, and I discuss them in my writings, whether it's the World Affairs Council or it's Gallup, countless polls on, are we winning the war on terror? Is the war in Iraq helping or hurting the war on terror? How is President Bush doing in the war on terror? Which candidate would wage the war on terror more effectively? But never, almost never, is it asked, should there be a war on terror? That's much more remarkable. You learn many more things from the polling questions than the polling answers, as a side note. So the third question I pose is, what is the image of the threat that is out there? And I'm going to telegraph my answer to that by sharing with you, this is a document you can download for free off the web from the Select Committee on Homeland Security called Freedom Defended, Implementing America's Strategy for Homeland Security. It was published in 2004, and there's a few gem-like quotations that inspire the entire publication, and one of them is from President Bush. We are today a nation at risk to a new and changing threat. The terrorist threat to America takes many forms, has many places to hide, and is often invisible, which is actually very handy for a threat. Secretary of Ridge, 2004, terrorists seek to infiltrate our society, scope out our targets, and wage war in our streets and cities. President Bush, July 2002, our society presents an almost infinite array of potential targets that can be attacked through a variety of methods. As I told you, they were gem-like quotes. The image is we are constantly at peril in almost every corner of the society. At the beginning of the policy paper, I quote from a typical scaremongering on television, which is based on Stephen Flynn's book, The Edge of Disaster. He's one of the leading war on terror propagandists who came out of the government and now has been associated with the Council on Foreign Relations. And if you look at that, you'll see that this is a depiction that strikes a little close to home, since it's about Philadelphia. everybody's down at the stadium watching a game, and all of a sudden, what happens is there's a truck filled with explosives is trundling through the back streets, but that's not the real problem. The real problem is going to the refinery. It's going to blow up this tank of hydrochlorofluoride gas, and then there's going to be a panic and a gridlock of hundreds of thousands of people, and tens of thousands will die. Okay, this was on television repeatedly. It's in the book. This is typical. Just think of in 2004, 2005 seasons of 24. That all that stood between us and the maniacal but brilliant terrorists hiding everywhere in the society was Jack Bauer. You know, a tiny number of non-corrupt, capable government officials. This is the narrative, the master narrative for the last 5 or 6 years for books and movies, television shows, you name it. So that's the image the country has of it being constantly under a threat from every direction. Fire hydrants, you know, they're one of the most vulnerable points in our society. And you have the waterworks industry is very excited about that. Shopping malls. I mean, I go into a great detail. I'll come back to that later. But there's literally no part of American society which is considered immune from terrorism. So the next question, if this is the hypothesis, this is the belief on which the base on a war on terror is based, that the threat is everywhere and it's overwhelming. So why no attacks? A dirty little question that doesn't get asked. And when it gets asked in the dead of the night, by some people in government, they don't talk about what they think the answer might be. But I'm asking it. Why no attacks? If they hate us so much, and if they're everywhere, and if, as the 9/11 Commission, those graybeards said, we don't have to talk much about what they want, those terrorists, because they all want the same thing. They want to kill as many Americans as possible. That's a direct quote from Lee Hamilton. Well, if that's what they want to do, why aren't there any attacks? Why haven't there been? Well, one possibility, which President Bush uses sometimes, is God's blessings or just sheer luck. I won't go any further with that one. Another argument that's often made is we've stopped them. It's our countermeasures. Well, there's absolutely zero evidence for this. Zero. Just look at any typical broadcast by Brian Ross about how some intern in his newscast carted in a truckload of fertilizer to a sensitive installation, or somebody carried a carpet bag full of things that said radioactive material across the Canadian border, got into a taxi and drove to a city. Or what I find most amazing, not amazing, but instructive, is at Newark's Liberty Airport, where the hijackers got on a plane, renamed. And you have in the airline security the one place we've actually done something that I think is probably pretty effective, you know, emphasized tremendous emphasis on security at airports. So in the November 2006, there was a government attempt to put 22 weapons through security at Newark Airport. 20 of them got through. Now, the fact is that every single red teaming exercise that I've heard of, and I've been involved in a few of them, they all work. Okay, they all work. It's very hard to see that our countermeasures have actually stopped anything. For one thing, it's obviously tremendously easy to kill Americans. It happens constantly, especially at college campuses or shopping malls. People are getting killed all the time, massacred in large numbers. The real miracle is not that there hasn't been a terrorist attack, but that none of these massacres have been carried out by someone with a Muslim last name. That's what's the real miracle. So, okay, still puzzling then. So easy to kill us. We haven't stopped them. How come no attacks? Well, maybe it's that it's the preparation. It's not that they haven't attacked yet, but they're all this preparation. Well, the fact is that we haven't been able to find any serious preparation for an attack. No sleeper cells. The FBI, in a confidential memo that was leaked in 2005, said, we have found no evidence of sleeper cells in the United States or no serious threat. That is still true. Out of 814,000 prosecutions that the Homeland Security that were prosecuted under the War on Terror laws, what did I say? 12 were actually related to terrorism or support for terrorists. 12 out of 814,000. There are many more statistics on this ratio of cases brought to actual evidence of anything, and a long discussion of this in the paper. In fact, there is so little evidence of anything happening that the entire War on Terror bureaucracy, the prosecutorial arm of it, has had to resort not just to the principle of preemptive prosecution in order to be able to get some action at all. Preemptive prosecution is you don't wait till an offense has been committed or till you can prove that an offense has been committed. You act when you think there might be an offense that has been committed. It's not just that preemptive prosecution. It is the criterion for proceeding now is, will we, the government, be able to defeat the entrapment defense that the accused will bring? Because it's all entrapment, almost. That is, whether it's Fort Dix or anywhere else, when you get over the first 3 weeks of War on Terror warrior chest thumping about what they've done and actually see what happened, you see that it's mostly the government informers that were producing the activity. So in order to proceed with a prosecution, the real judgment is they're going to bring an entrapment defense. In this War on Terror context, can we get a jury to not accept that defense? And that is really the argument that goes on in these trials, not guilt or innocence, terrorist threat, or anything like that. Okay, so no attacks, but maybe no preparations of any serious kind, but maybe we're just not looking, you know, hard enough. Well, that doesn't seem to be true. The FBI's budget has doubled since 2001, and the entire extra money, 50% of what it spends is on counterterror, which is its official highest priority. So it's like the entire FBI before 2001 is doing nothing but looking. And, of course, they're not exactly constrained in how they can look. We all know now about tens of thousands of national security letters written every year. We know about the surveillance. Well, we don't know about all the surveillance. We've only heard about a lot of it. But there's absolutely no indication that any privacy laws or respect for the rights of American persons, let alone citizens, is interfering with the ability of the War on Terror prosecutorial arm to find information it may think could in some way lead them to someone who might be participating or materially supportive of terrorism. So it's hard to buy the story that we're just not looking hard enough. So with so little evidence of a threat, then the question is, why are we having a $1 trillion war on terror? Why? Now, that question has to be broken into two questions, and I want you to focus on this. There are actually two questions that have to be answered. One is why it started, and another is why it continues. Those are two different questions, and they have slightly different answers. How did it start? Why was it our response to 9/11 and not some much more healthy response? The answer to that has to do with Iraq and has to do with a supremacist cabal that was waiting in the wings to wage a war in Iraq, lacking only the ability to convince anyone outside their cloistered meeting rooms who would support it. And what they saw was that after 9/11, somehow they had to get the emotion and political capital associated with the horror and fury over 9/11 linked to Iraq. But, of course, there was a little problem since Iraq had nothing to do with it. Saddam Hussein, for all his demerits, had nothing to do with it. But they were able, over a year's time, to fashion the discourse so that what was a war on terrorism with global reach became a global war on terror, in which the central front would be the war in Iraq that they wanted. In order to get that energy focused on what they wanted, the war in Iraq is the first in a series of neocon victories, neo-imperialist wars, they needed a formula that would be broad enough to link anything we didn't like to the war on terror, to what they wanted. So what came out of that was the idea of a war on terror. It's either you're either with us or against us. And we have the right to strike first if you're not with us. When you put those two things together, you logically have the right to attack any country at any time. And it made the war in Iraq a part of the war on terror. So we are not fighting in Iraq because it is the central front in the war on terror. We are stuck with an enervating, disastrous, counterproductive war on terror because of the desire to fight in Iraq and therefore the need to invent something like the war on terror. Now, that's how come we got into this war on terror. Now the question, how come we stayed in it without the threat? When there's no threat, why does it stay? And there you come to the dynamics of American politics. The whirlwind. You know, Congress, when it first heard about the war on terror, well, started licking its chops. The Department of Homeland Security came up with a list of targets that needed to be protected, 160 targets or so. The Congress did not like that list for the obvious reasons. There are 430-something odd, you know, districts, congressional districts. You're not going to get funding in every district if you only have 160 targets. Within 6 months, the number went up to over 1,000. Within a year, it was over 17,000. The next year, it was over 25,000. Then 77,000. By the end of 2006, they had to change the categories to accommodate so that they wouldn't leave localities out who wanted to be targets. 300,000 and counting. So you just take that one example and multiply it across the lobbying activities, and you find out what kind of a whirlwind the war on terror became. I'll give you a couple examples that are in the paper. The National Rifle Association, what do you think its reaction to the war on terror was? Proves what we've always said. Americans need guns, and they need to know how to use them in order to defend themselves against the terrorists. Well, you may chuckle, but what did the gun control lobby say? It said, just what we've always said. To keep the guns out of the hands of terrorists, we need strict gun control laws. Now, what do you learn from this? I can tell you, pediatricians, veterinary schools, starved of funds. Who's going to protect us but us? Vet schools against hoof and mouth disease that the terrorists are going to send in here. And we've been starved for funds for decades, as we've always, in other words, everybody said the same thing. As we've always said, it's even more true now. No one could get They had to take the boilerplate out of their funding in lobbying proposals and insert war on terror into it. That was true of government, of universities applying for grants across the board, corporations, everything. Just the number of NSF grants proposals that had the word terror in them skyrocketed, even though the actual research didn't change whatsoever. A couple other, if I may, very brief examples of this, because to me, this is the really crucial thing. The cabal that started the war isn't in control of it anymore. There's no one in control of the war on terror. It is a thing in itself that is trying to control the country. That's what makes it so difficult. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, just see what happened to President Bush when he tried to say, it's okay if the Dubai company takes care of the ports. He couldn't say it. The war on terror wouldn't let him. In the Department of Homeland Security, they gave out billions of dollars to local and state governments, and they figured out that they had to have some official criterion for doing this. So they came up with 15 national planning scenarios, which they tried to keep secret, but which were published on the Hawaii state website. They were taken down from the Hawaii state website. I happened to find them on the Iowa state website, and so I was able to discuss them. I knew about them from other sources. Well, these are fascinating. How did they decide on these 15? In order to qualify for funding, if you were a state or county or a local government, you had to say that your locality, your state, was threatened by one of these 15. For one of them, for example, was hoof and mouth disease. Another one was some kind of attack on a sports stadium. You didn't have liquid natural gas tanker attack. That was not part of them. You didn't have West Nile virus. You did have anthrax. You did have smallpox. There were kind of 15. Who produced this list? Well, it was a list that bubbled up out of the government bureaucracy and partly on the basis of who would win and who would lose depending on which scenarios got included in the appropriate justifications for funding. So it's a political process, not an analytic process. And it's most apparent when you say, well, who did they say the enemy would be in these scenarios? Because if you say who the enemy is, that limits what kind of attacks you could imagine and therefore limits the kind of funding that you could apply for, people could apply for. Well, I was fascinated to see the name of the enemy, the universal adversary. In other words, Satan. Every bad thing that can happen, you can't. Now, I found out, much to my amazement, and I was probably the last person that should have been amazed, that there still exists an office of the universal adversary. In the Department of Homeland Security, though you won't find it on the web, but I have the name and phone number of the person who runs it, and she just sent me materials about it. It is fantastic. They're in charge of developing fictionalized scenarios. It doesn't say why they use the term. I'm telling you why they use the term. Okay. I'll save other examples for later, or you can just read about them in the paper. All right, so why no attacks? And why was there an attack? Because now we get to the question, is there going to be another attack? Is there a threat? What is it? Am I saying there's no terrorism threat? No, I'm not saying that. You have to understand why the 9/11 attack occurred in order to understand why there haven't been any since. It was a desperate attempt by a failed group of fanatics who had not been able to do what they wanted in the Middle East and were reaching for a far enemy in some dramatic fashion to try to trigger a transformation in the Middle East that would help them and make them seem to masses of Muslims as heroes and as people who are speaking the truth about the world rather than as nutcases. It's as if the Aryan nation, which commands now about the same level of support in the United States as Al-Qaeda did before 9/11 in the Muslim world, had said, how are we ever going to, we know the truth and nobody's listening to us. What are we going to do? Well, if they could have engineered an attack on Nairobi and had a black African Muslim army invade the United States then they would be the resistance heroes. And that's what Al-Qaeda did. Partly blind luck and partly brilliant strategy. But fundamentally, it's a form of violence that's using judo. The principle of judo is you use your enemy's strength against him. And that's what they did. They hijacked our planes, our transportation system, to knock down those buildings. Then, and this is what Americans don't realize, they hijacked our entire Madisonian democratic system of red-blooded American factional infighting for everybody goes for everything they can get. Because by transforming the agenda of we have to fight these barbarians, everybody has to say that I should get more funding. Or in my agency, we should have a bigger budget because we're carrying the ball in the war on terror. And every agency in the government and sub-agency had to make that argument after 9/11 or be starved of funds. So this whole Madisonian principle was hijacked. Our American political system was hijacked. And that's what thrust us into Iraq. And that's what's got us caught up in a war that no one between the people operating in the trenches and knocking down the doors, and those at the very top who've eaten the Kool-Aid, that the vast professional managerial class know that it's a complete crock. But they can't get out of it. I don't know how many people I've talked to who admit, whether they're high-ranking members of Congress or inside of these organizations, yes, we know it's nuts, but if we don't get the money, they'll get it, and they will waste it. At least we're doing something useful with it. I gave a talk on this. I gave this essentially the same talk to the Department of Homeland Security. When I asked why I was being invited, they said to a week-long course on how to fight the war on terror, the head of the institute said, "We can't say it. You can." I got some more details about that encounter. The first question I had from the audience was, "Are you wearing a bulletproof vest?" The last question was very different. It was, how come, are all members of Congress getting your book? They're trapped. I'm not blaming politicians. The press, professors, I'm blaming a little bit because they're the press and the tenured professoriate, they're the ones who are not supposed to race to the trough. They're supposed to use protected status of tenure and freedom of expression to speak the truth even when it's unpopular, but they have not. Okay, the press fell down on the war in Iraq. The professors actually spoke against the war in Iraq. When it comes to the war on terror, both of them are not only lying down, they're making money hand over fist. I also consult in the war on terror. That's how come I know most of this stuff. And we can get into the, exactly how can I do that in the question period. So this is a judo. How do you fight somebody who's using judo? one attritional side means you kind of slump, but you don't treat them as if they're really a danger to you. You don't honor them with a war when what they want is the image of fighting an apocalyptic war against you. You do what the British and the Europeans, who have a much more serious threat than we do, and reject the idea of a war on terror, and you treat it as a problem that is handled within the institutions of law and order that we have in our society and with the constitutional protections of everyone intact. You don't do them the honor of putting them in the same category as Imperial Japan or Nazi Germany. That's exactly what they want, and that's exactly what they got. Instead, what we have, and I'll conclude here, is we've got a kind of fad of Chicken Little. On the left, it's global warming, and I'm somebody who believes in global warming, but I don't think that we need to run around with our like Chicken Little and forget everything else. The same thing with the war on terror. Those who criticize the environmentalists as if they are Chicken Littles are themselves much bigger Chicken Littles when it comes to the war on terror, thinking behind every rock there's a danger that'll overthrow the country, or at least talking as if they think that way. Instead, what we have to do is we have to overcome the war on terror itself. We have to begin a discourse that analyzes its logic. We can't allow it to tell us who we are and what we should be. We can't accept politicians who use slogans when they respond to questions about the war on terror. We have to know our enemy. In this case, our enemy is a small group of crazy fanatics, and we need to use our intelligence and our police and our military assets as necessary to deal with them, discreetly, behind the scenes, and with everyone who will cooperate. That's not something we can do when we politicize the war on terror as we have done. And we have to do what we did with the Soviet Union, which is to get over 5 years of McCarthyist hysteria, in which we believed there were sleeper cells ready to take over the country. And we were able to manage psychologically, politically, and militarily with a much more difficult, much more serious real threat against us of the incineration of our cities. And we were able to prevail in that struggle, and we were able to live a happy, satisfying national life and not waste trillions of dollars in counterproductive bridges to nowhere. Thank you.